owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. When describing today's guest, an Army Special Forces soldier said, "If I didn't know any better, I would have thought he was a former special operator himself. He had that look. To me, he was what a war correspondent should look like." While our guest never wore the uniform, he has spent a great deal of time in war zones documenting the stories of our warriors in both print and film. Many experts consider him to be one of the greatest writers of our generation. The fact that he has written no fewer than 4 books that have achieved New York Times bestseller status and a documentary nominated for an Academy Award certainly back up that claim. As for me, I'm not a book critic. I'm just an avid reader. But what I will say is that, in my opinion, our guest is one of the most insightful translators of the nature of the human condition that I've ever read. And we're very fortunate to have him making a return appearance on American Warrior Radio. His latest book, Freedom, should be on the bookshelves when you hear this broadcast. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, Mr. Sebastian Junger.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was easy. Now, Sebastian, I got to tell you, in our business, in my business, your business, publicists are very kind, and they usually send out a list of suggested interview questions. But being a man of free will myself, I'm pretty much going to ignore them, and we'll attempt to have just a freewheeling chat. Is that okay with you?
That sounds good. And, you know, they do that because this may come as a shock, but some radio hosts don't read the books that get sent to them. So it's those questions are kind of a cheat sheet for people that are, you know, too busy or whatever to read the book. So I appreciate that you read my book.
Get out of here. Yes, I did read it cover to cover. And honestly, it's, well, I know you don't get paid by the ounce, but it's one of your thinnest books. But it stirred so much. I mean, reading your book, Sebastian, I was bouncing off in 18 different directions. And I really encourage everyone to read it because it's going to inspire them to think more and to challenge some of the notions that I think a lot of us as Americans have held for such a long time. But you've written in quite a few diverse veins, from the rough life of seafaring fishermen to war to the Boston Strangler. What brought you to writing the book Freedom?
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, it is a short book. It's like Tribe, which was my previous book. And they're both books about ideas, concepts. And, you know, if you're documenting the loss of a ship or a murder mystery or a deployment, you want to be sort of comprehensive, and there's a certain amount of information and detail that you want to capture. With ideas, it's a little different. And I feel like you want to say what the most important core of your idea you want to communicate in the fewest words possible, because people are busy. They don't have a lot of time necessarily. And if it's an important idea, you want to kind of get in and get out. That was what I tried to do with this book. So Freedom, like our tribe, our community, our people, freedom is one of the few things that people are willing to die for. You know, people will die for their community, be it their country or their family, whatever it may be. They'll die for that, and they'll die for their freedom. And it's a core human value. And life without a solid community or without freedom can seem pointless and meaningless. And so I sort of think of them together. So for me, Freedom was the follow-on to my book, Tribe. And what I was trying to figure out is what gives us our autonomy in the world. By freedom, I mean the freedom to be self-defining. And the human conundrum, I mean, we're social primates. At the end of the day, we're animals, but we're very, very special animals. And our safety, and you can understand safety to be an aspect of our freedom. If you're not safe, if you're in danger, your freedom is very constrained, right? So our security comes from the fact that we're part of a group. Humans die in nature. But the humans alone die in nature very quickly. We don't survive very well alone, but we thrive in groups. And all of our possibility and our security in the world and our freedom comes from the fact that we're in a group that can help defend us, right? But as soon as you're part of a group, you have to sort of cooperate with its norms, with its rules. And that's where freedom gets complicated and interesting.
Sure.
And I tried to sort that out in this short book.
Speaking of sorting, Sebastian, I don't think I've ever read a book that only had three chapters. Run, fight, think. Why did you choose those three elements as you're helping to define freedom for us?
Yeah, so I was trying to understand what allows us to maintain our autonomy in the face of a greater power, which is really, at the end of the day, what freedom means. And throughout human history, for thousands of years, what has allowed us to do that? And the first thing that people try, that groups try, is they try to outrun their oppressor. Mobility gives a lot of people their freedom. And whether that is, the Comanche in Texas, or, a motorcycle gang or whatever, the fact that you're not rooted in one place gives you a lot of possibilities. And so so the book is divided into run, fight, and think, because those are the three things that give you a chance at being self-defining. Basically, if you can't outrun your oppressor, like the Comanche or the Apache also did very effectively for 300 years, the Pueblo tribes in the Southwest, very wealthy, rooted in place in their towns, the Spanish ruled them immediately. The Apache remained autonomous until almost 1900. So 1886 was the last group of Apache that were finally confined and subdued. If you can't outrun your oppressor, you're going to have to outfight them. Well, and one of the interesting things – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, you give another great example in the book. I think it's the Seminole Nation and just how they – I think you said, weren't they the only one that actually signed a treaty that was reasonably fair with the U.S.
Well,
government?
They never signed a legal treaty. Every other tribe signed a legally binding treaty with the United States after they were defeated. The Seminole were never defeated.
Hmm.
The U.S. military went into the swamps of Central Florida twice with huge expeditions and just got their hat handed to them. And they eventually gave up. Mm-hmm. And there were Seminole, but in the 1930s, there were still Seminole in Central Florida in the swamps that had never been contacted or had been outside, in American society. They were completely uncontacted into my mother's lifetime.
Now,
right. And yeah,
kind of a departure, but really this is something I've always been curious about, sir. In both tribes and in freedom, you talk a lot and you use a lot of references to the indigenous tribes in your writings and your films. Is that, do you have a personal connection there, or is it just always fascinated you?
Well, I'm writing for an American audience, and until fairly recently, you had a modern Western society that was living cheek to jowl with a basically Stone Age Native society, and I was fascinated by that interaction. One of the things I pointed out in Tribe is that people from this society along the frontier were constantly crossing over and adopting an Indian lifestyle, and the Native did not do that. I mean, eventually they got confined onto reservations and what have you, but the opposite just almost never happened. And for a sort of like superior feeling Christian society, this was a troubling fact, right? And even Benjamin Franklin wrote about, like, why is it that our society is so unappealing to the natives? And yet their society, a Stone Age society, is so appealing to our young men and often young women. There are people that were captured in the Indian Wars and adopted into Native tribes. And often those people, when they were given the chance to return to white society, American society, they refused. They wanted to stay with their tribe.
Interesting.
So that to me is, you can understand yourselves through the opposite, through the enemy or whatever. And so looking at American society through the eyes of the Native people is a very interesting way of understanding, both of our benefits and also, frankly, our deficits, where we are an unappealing, a difficult society to belong to.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Sebastian Junger. You can learn more. Visit SebastianJunger.com. That's spelled JUNGER. His latest book, Freedom, I honestly endorse this. I encourage everyone to read it. Early on, as I cracked the book and started turning the pages, there's one quote that just hit me like a splash of cold water across the face. Sebastian says, once you have spent years digging irrigation ditches or picking stones out of a wheat field or working at a law firm, you almost have no leverage with which to insist on your autonomy or anyone else's. The choice is to either rise up or submit, and many hardworking people understandably choose to submit. More with Sebastian Unger when we come right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Very pleased to be chatting again with Sebastian Unger. Sebastian, I can't remember the last time you were on, but you've had a great deal of success, and I love following your work, and I mean that. Just great, all your books and the documentary, great reads. One of the documentaries, in Freedom, we see, we kind of sort of follow the path. Let me see if I can get this correct. It's not my first language, Sebastian, so be patient with me. You sort of introduce the topics as part of the exploration that you and your fellows experienced during your 400-mile hike walk that was featured in the documentary, The Last Patrol. Were the seeds of the idea for this Freedom book planted during that walk for you?
You know, actually not. You would think they would have been, but this was a number of years ago that we did this. We walked along the railroad lines from Washington, D.C. to Philadelphia, and then we turned west, and we headed for Pittsburgh. We walked the length of Pennsylvania, much of it on the Juniata River. And we picked the railroad lines because they're sort of no man's territory, and there's a lot of sort of marginal people there. There's no very little police, very little oversight. You can kind of do what you want. You got to watch out, but it's sort of wide open. And, you know, we were sleeping under bridges and in abandoned buildings and, you know, and the railroad lines go right through the middle of everything, junkyards and industry and farms and ghettos and everything else. And we really wanted to sort of encounter this country at 3 miles an hour, you know, like right through the thick of it. And, so we did this 400-mile walk, you know, and we called it high-speed vagrancy. We were basically vagrants, but we really moved pretty fast. One day we did a 40 miles in 40 hours. But, you know, we were carrying loads, right? We were in ultramarathoners. We were fully loaded and had all, you know, we were sleeping out in the rough and we had to cook dinner and, you know, we get our water out of creeks and, you know, whatever. So, you know, years later, I'm sort of thinking, formulating this book about freedom and this idea that, you know, If you can't outrun your oppressor, you have to outfight them. If you can't outfight them, you're going to have to outthink them. And I was sort of thinking through this. I was like, when was I personally at my freest? And, of course, there's many ways to define freedom. So, it depends, it's in the eye of the beholder. But for me, what I realized was just in a sheer sort of animal, physical sense, over the course of 400 miles, we were the only people, you know, most nights, we were the only people who knew where we were. And, you know, we slept in some weird places, right? And we were the only people who knew we were there. And I thought, that's a really interesting definition of freedom, one of many. And so I added a narrative about the trip because not only was it a sort of portrait of America and its people, but it was also such a hard-won experience of freedom for me and my buddies that did this.
Yeah, you touched on something I want to follow up on because that quote or that line in your book that I played just before the break, yeah. I mean, that really was a splash of cold water. I mean, most people understandably choose to submit. And, of course, my visceral reaction is, well, not me, you know. But then I started reading through your book, and it really got me thinking about it. There, Sebastian, there's the words freedom and liberty seem to have gotten to a point where they're used interchangeably. But they're not. I mean, freedom really is an internal construct, what goes on, you know, between our ears, whereas liberty is an external construct, really the ability to exercise that freedom in a society. So let me ask you, is that a strictly binary decision? I mean, can someone have freedom and liberty in a cubicle?
Well, okay, well, here's the thing. You know, it becomes a very philosophical debate that I actually didn't engage in, and I think maybe a lot of viewers or listeners will breathe a sigh of relief. I did not engage in the highest level of, like, philosophical inquiry. But what I'll say is this, that, I mean, going back to the quote that you read, there was a point about 10,000 years ago where people started to practice agriculture. That made them a lot wealthier. But it also bound them to the land. And when you dig irrigation ditches and prepare a field and et cetera, you can't just pick up and go if someone's if a ruler is trying to tyrannize you, right? I mean, you're stuck because you've invested years of backbreaking labor in your land. And so that the split that happened 10,000 years ago is that some people settled down and planted, and it made them wealthier but subject to oppression. Other people remained nomadic, and it meant that they were constantly on the move, materially poor, but they could not be controlled by an outside power. They were running. They were mobile, the first section of my book. And that's your wealth is a form of freedom, right? It frees you up from the dangers and hardships of the natural world. So, again, it's however you want to – whatever the most important definition of the word is to you, that's the form you should work on. And, you know – yeah, I mean, if you have a mortgage on a house, it's great to have your own house, right? It's a form of freedom, but that probably means you have to go to work every morning, which doesn't always feel like freedom. You know, it's this constant trade-off. And, basically, as you accumulate wealth and security, you end up giving up a certain amount of autonomy. And it's just, and that was true 10,000 years ago. It's still true.
Now, far be it for me to give advice to a multiple best-selling author, Sebastian, but, you know, that – when you write your next book, you might want to consider that high-level philosophical discussion you're going to get on American Warrior Radio.
Well, listen, I'm happy to talk through it with you. What I heard is that the difference between freedom and liberty is that liberty requires duties, obligations. That liberty is something that you participate in and work at. Freedom is a sort of state of being. You're either free or you're not. But liberty is something that has to be preserved through your actions. And, you know, basically in a free society, which is what we live in large part because of our democracy and our rule of law, in a free society, you know, a fair question is how much do we owe our society? What kind of contribution do we owe our society in exchange for this enormous freedom that we live in? And, you know, again, that doesn't mean the freedom to have the politician we like best like win every election. That's not a form of freedom. It's very painful for both Democrats and Republicans to have their person lose, right? That's not what freedom is about, though. It's about a fair process where no one has extra rights, where the leaders, the political leaders, the generals, the powerful people, the very wealthy people, they don't have extra rights. They only have the rights that everyone else has.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I tell you, the thing, folks, read this book, Freedom, because one of the things I enjoy, Sebastian, extensively researched, and you're, you know, everything from chimpanzees to, basic biology, and really sort of that, okay, here comes the Ben States, the obvious segment of our show. You know, freedom wasn't invented during the American Revolution. I mean, when Fred and Wilma came out of their cave every day, their focus was simply on surviving. I mean, the most basic pillars of the hierarchy of needs. And after reading your book, it kind of made me think about it. You know, they didn't have to fight to be free, but they were free because they had to fight. And as technology emerges, for example, today you talk a lot about trains in the book and how really the trains facilitated that westward expansion and how that granted to some extent more freedom to at least the Caucasian populace. And it made me think about the interwebs. And, you know, all of us are now walking around with a computer in our pocket. And it made me wonder, well, did that make us free, or is that just another form of chains that hold us down? What is your thought on that?
Well, I would say that anything that distracts you and takes you further from yourself, your conscious self, is a form of entanglement and a reduction of your freedom. I interviewed a guy. He's not in the book, but he was a very interesting interview. He did some decades in prison for, you know, committing the most serious kind of crime there is. And he got out of good behavior eventually, but he educated himself. He was from a very, very tough background. All the predictors of, incarceration were in his youth, unfortunately for him. And at any rate, he educated himself. He's an amazing, amazing man. And I asked him at the end, I said, is it possible to be more free in prison than outside of prison? He was like, oh, man, of course it is. Like, there's no possibility to be addicted to anything inside prison. And there's not aren't even any distractions. There's nothing but you, and eventually you are going to come to an honest accounting of yourself and who you are. And no one's free until they've done that. And he was like, you know, this thing, and he picked up his phone. He was like, this thing will always keep you from really experiencing yourself in its most profound form. And there's no distraction in prison. So in some ways, it's the freest place there is.
Outstanding. Well,
by the way, I have a flip phone. I don't have one of those phones.
No kidding.
Just so that you know. Yeah.
Where do you even find one of those nowadays?
You can get them, you know, like, I mean, whatever. Verizon sells them. I don't even think they know they sell them, but they do sell them.
I don't have to go on the dark web or anything, right, Sebastian?
No.
We're good. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Sebastian Junger, multiple best-selling author, great documentary producer. Some people out there in the military consider him one of the best combat journalists there has been since Ernie Pyle. But this book, Freedom, I encourage you to get it and read it. You can visit SebastianJunger.com. There was another line out of the book, Sebastian, talking about your last patrol, and you said, the things that happened, that had to happen out there were so clear and simple. Eat, walk, hide, sleep. That just getting through the day felt like scripture. And I'm thinking a lot of us need to remember that. We get wrapped around the axle so often, and you touched on that. Maybe we should all get back to the basics in our daily lives. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back with more with Sebastian Junger. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. Talking with one of my favorite guests ever, Sebastian Junger. You can find out more about his works at SebastianJunger.com. And I say that, you know, Sebastian, you asked who their favorite guest is, like, who's your favorite child? That's not really a fair question. But really, I can always look forward to a very stimulating conversation with you. In your book, Freedom, you introduced something I'd never heard of. Is it Gini coefficient or Gini coefficient?
The Gini coefficient, yeah, G-I-N-I. It was named after an Italian economist from about 100 years ago.
Hey, give our listeners a Reader's Digest version of what that is and how that played into your discussion.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. You know, basically, it's a measure of the income gap in a country. And it's measured from 0 to 1.0. And so the most egalitarian societies, like the sort of small-scale hunter-gatherer societies, I mean, the kind of societies that humans evolved from, and, you know, for 100,000 years, we basically lived at that level of existence of small groups of, 30, 40, 50 people existing in the wild, completely interdependent on each other, with very little sort of class, what you would call class difference in this society, very little differences of, I mean, there are no accumulation of wealth, and no hereditary leadership, anything like that. It was very egalitarian. And so they have a Gini coefficient of 0.25, right? So it's way closer to complete equality than complete monopoly by anybody. And then as you sort of go up the industrial, you know, through sort of the history of the Western world, the Gini coefficient starts to climb. And so then you have, you know, kings and nobility in medieval Europe that were enormously powerful and wealthy, and everyone else were peasants. In that era, there was a Gini coefficient of almost 0.8, right? Almost at the maximum of 1.0. The United States is around 0.41. You know, it's basically on the level of the Roman Empire. But what's interesting about it, I mean, whatever you might personally feel about an egalitarian society or not, what's interesting about it is that the empires, the societies that have really dominated world history, the Han Dynasty, the Romans, the British Empire, the American Empire, the American experiment, have, you know, moderate, not crazy high, but sort of moderately high Gini coefficients. It seems to be very difficult to dominate history, to dominate world events, and have a very, very sort of economically flat egalitarian society. I'm not arguing for either one, but it's just an interesting observation.
Well, and you mentioned before in our conversation that really a lot of this is a matter of perspective, and I guess from a pure mathematical perspective, the sweet spot would be 0.5, you know, using that coefficient. But the effect of whether wealth actually sets us free or and chains us. You're talking about, in your book, you said freedom, you're talking particularly about the American frontier and how those individual pioneers would somehow have to band together just to survive. And you said freedom and safety seem to exist on a continuum where the more you had of one, the less you had of other. And one of the things I love, I think, is complimentary of a great author like yourself, is I find myself reading and applying that to my own lives or my own community. And Sebastian, 30 years ago when I left the corporate world to become an independent contractor, I always thought like I was trading financial safety for my own freedom. And frankly, honestly, I'm thinking of going back to safety with what's going on right now. But where would you place the average American on that continuum today?
Well, okay, yeah, so it's complicated. There's several things going on here. Wealth liberates us from the threats and hardships of the natural world, right? And so when you plant crops, you're insulating yourself from the vagaries of hunting and scavenging and foraging, right? But you're very much tied to a labor schedule and very possibly to mortgage payments on the land and maybe an overseer, maybe an emperor. I mean, you could be tied to all kinds of onerous things, but you're not subject to the sort of whims of nature, right? And so that's what happened with the people along the Pennsylvania frontier. You know, they left the colonies, which were, you know, along the eastern seaboard, which is a fairly oppressive society, right? And likewise, the church. I mean, you know, that it was a very, very controlling presence in the lives of many, many Americans before and after the Revolution. So, people would leave and go into the wilderness, you know, what was called Indian Territory, which was enormously free, right? No, nothing freer than that. The equivalent of going into the Alaskan bush right now by yourself, right? But the problem is, the freer you are out there, the more danger you're in, because it's a dangerous environment. And so what the settlers did was they were free of the sort of like scrutiny of the government, because this was really no man's land. But they were in a lot of danger, so they had a sort of mutual defense pact with each other. And when there were sort of Indian wars, raids along the frontier, it was a very bloody time in both directions. Everyone was really committed to a kind of mutual defense pact. Everyone met, you know, sort of rushed to the stockade, and everyone inside the stockade, they really had to fight. In one form or another, and you know, particularly for the men, the adult males, like if you did not at all times carry a gun, a scalping knife, and a tomahawk, you were basically shunned and cast out of the community because you weren't prepared to defend the community. And that's not a form of freedom, right? You were not free to not fight. You were not free to do what you want. You had to commit possibly your very life to the defense of the group. So basically, there is no such thing as complete freedom and complete safety and complete comfort. We get our safety and comfort from others, and that is often antithetical to a complete vision of freedom.
When, in your opinion, Sebastian, did we evolve, is not the right word, but change? Because you bring out the fact that historically, most of the freest people were often also the most warlike. They had to be. And, you know, coming back to the Fred and Wilma reference, but when did we sort of get away from that?
Well, okay, so...
In a good way.
So the word freedom comes from the Middle German Friedem, which means beloved. And basically the idea was that the people that you considered free, in other words, that they could not be enslaved or killed or tortured or anything else, were exempt from that kind of abuse, were the people within your own community, your tribe, your clan, whatever it may have been. And everyone else was eligible for whatever you could manage to do to them. And so basically as a community, if you couldn't defend yourself against an outside enemy, you were potentially going to be killed or enslaved. As an example, 5,000 years ago during the Neolithic era, a marauding group of extremely aggressive people named the Yamnaya from the Russian steppe, the Eastern steppe, they traveled on horse-drawn chariots without women. It was like the first motorcycle gang, right? And they cruised right through Europe, and they invaded the Iberian Peninsula, Spain and Portugal. And within 100 years, we know this from the DNA of people in Iberia right now, within about 100 years, they killed all the men in Iberia, in Neolithic era Iberia, all of the men, not the women. They mated with the women. Mm-hmm. But the men were completely scrubbed from the human gene pool because they could not defend their territory. It was an extreme, it was the ultimate loss of freedom, is that it was essentially a genocide. So if you can't defend yourself, your freedom is at risk from an outside power. But the problem is, if you're well organized enough to defend yourself against the Yamnaya or anybody else, you're also well organized enough as a ruler, as a leader of a group like that, to oppress your own people, right? To subject your own people to control. And that's where individual rights come in. Ultimately that's where democratic rights and rule of law come in. So, you know, rights are, you know, freedom is defended from outsiders. But within your own society, you're not talking about freedom, you're talking about your rights. And rights are collectively decided. And, you know, the point where the government exists in part to help preserve human life within its society and keep people fed and housed and everything else. And, you know, we all have different opinions about the government, but, you know, essentially its function is to preserve the society that we're in. But where that caretaking becomes petty and overly controlling and onerous, you know, that's sort of in the eye of the beholder. So a regulation banning dumping mercury into the watershed, you know, in some ways we're impinging on the freedom of the whatever industry that is to make maximize its profit, but we're protecting everyone else's welfare. It's a constant argument. No one's completely right. No one's completely wrong. The left and the right will be arguing about this forever. They both have merit. Both sides have merit. But that's where you get this idea of rights within your society. And that's where I think a lot of arguments are happening right now, particularly around COVID and things like that.
Wait, what?
Yeah, particularly around COVID and things like that. Yeah, you heard me.
Yeah, and frankly, that's why you know, the timing of your book could not be more perfect, maybe for the good reasons for you and the rest of us. But, yeah, we definitely live in intriguing times. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Sebastian Junger. You can find out more about his books and other works, sebastianjunger.com. One more quote before we take the break. Hopefully it will lead us into our next discussion. You touched on it already, Sebastian. The central problem for human freedom is that groups are well-organized enough to defend themselves and others are well-organized enough to oppress their own. Democracy, both in its modern form and its original indigenous form, is an attempt to balance the two. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Sebastian Junger about his new book, Freedom, and just overall kind of broad philosophies, which is why he makes such a great guest. You can learn more, visit SebastianJunger.com. Sebastian, I want to play a little clip for you here and then get your take on what you hear.
You really appreciate it. You know what I mean? Like, I there's nowhere else to go. America is the last bastion of freedom on the planet.
That, Sebastian, was from an interview we did with the British actor Matthew Marsden, and his role in Black Hawk Down really changed his life. He's now since immigrated to the U.S. He's become a U.S. citizen. And I got to tell you, of all the interviews, that, you know, hearing that come from somebody with a very distinctive British voice talking about freedom in America, I mean, that just, it threw me for a loop. And it warms my heart, but also nowadays it caused me a little bit of worry. You say, coming back to the train reference in your book, you say the only force that can bring a freight train to a dead stop is another freight train moving in the opposite direction. And you allude to America in that context. Can you sort of expound on that thought for us?
Yeah, I mean, we're the most powerful country in the world. And, you know, Al-Qaeda is not going to bring us down. ISIS isn't going to bring us down. They're a security threat, but they're not going to bring down the society and strip us of our democracy, right? And our democracy is sacred. You know, every person has a vote now. It took a while for the country to get there, but now every person deserves a vote. And it's a, you know, truly representative process where, you know, about half the time the Republicans are in control and about half the time the Democrats are. And that's roughly how the population is split. So it all seems fairly fair and, you know, so roughly fair. And so in a system that's that powerful and that politically stable, I know it doesn't feel that way right now, but democracies are very, very stable, you know, in part because there's a peaceful transfer of power. Dictatorships have a very, very short shelf life. The dictatorships like Saddam Hussein, Augusto Pinochet, Franco, those kinds of regimes don't transfer very well. They don't last very long, right? So, but democracies do. They're very resilient. So the only thing that can really bring that down is if the country gets into a fight with itself. I mean, the U.S. is just too powerful for anyone else to manage to do that. And, you know, and that means that we have to be very, very conscious of any rhetoric, any process within our country that seeks to marginalize the other side of the equation, right? When Republicans marginalize Democrats or vice versa, what you're basically arguing for is a divorce, like a split, and that's the end of everything. And so I think one of the most important things, you know, we all have differences of opinion politically and otherwise, like in any marriage, right? It's a lot like a marriage. But what we have to really strive to do is signal everybody, both sides of the political equation have to signal, look, I may disagree with you, but I want you to be part of the process. And I'm willing to negotiate with you for a solution that a majority of Americans can respect and approve of. And, you know, I think we've, for very complicated reasons, I think we've sort of lost that temporarily.
I couldn't agree with you more, and it causes me to lose, and I don't lose sleep very often, but lately I have.
Right.
Now, Sebastian, one thing, and I might be going too far with this, but just bear with me because I am just a poor immigrant, yeah. But you have a lot of divergent, almost, in freedom, it's almost like an ADHD process. Forgive me, sir, for saying that, but and you even, you talk about biology and physiology in boxing, with particular references to Muhammad Ali and just what an amazing fighter he was. You talk about the cues and the signals that the brain has to decode in order to dodge punches and just how quickly all that happens. And you do say a broad general focus rather than fixating on your opponent's fist is the key to avoiding those punches. Given what you just said, I'm wondering, what are those kind of, are there equivalent cues that we as a society and as members of a society should be looking for that would sort of parallel that? I mean, what kind of cues would we look for to avoid that punch?
Right. Well, I mean, let me just sort of explain that humans are rare and possibly completely unique among mammals in that a smaller combatant, a smaller individual can physically defeat in combat a larger one, right? And, you know, chimpanzees and the rest of the animal kingdom, the largest male, physically dominates everyone else. And it scales up. So small insurgencies can defeat great armies. The Montenegrins are a fierce mountain people. And the Ottoman Empire, which was the dominant military force in the world at the time, the early 1600s, invaded Montenegro, an incredibly poor place, right? Invaded it over and over again. And the Montenegrins were outnumbered 12 to 1 by the Ottoman Empire, right? And every time they completely defeated and routed the Ottomans. And so that is unique, right? That a smaller power, and without, if that weren't true, America wouldn't exist. Britain would have won the war. If smaller groups couldn't do that, there would basically be no freedom in the world. That there'd be these sort of like dominant mega states that subjected everyone. But that's not what the world looks like. And another example, frankly, is the Taliban, who I loathe. But, you know, they fought us the Russians to a standstill for 10 years and then fought us to a standstill for 20 years. They kind of did it, right? They kind of pulled it off. So, you're asking for the political equivalent in this country in terms of what could destroy us. I mean, I think I would just sort of reiterate what I said. The marriage counselors, one of the great truths that they focus on when they're counseling people who love each other but are having a difficult time with each other, that when contempt creeps into the conversation, the marriage is probably over. And there are married couples who can fight all day long, but at the end of the day, they respect the other person, and they don't talk with them with contempt. And one of the things, the very dangerous things that has crept into political rhetoric in the last years, is the use of contempt for the other people in the other party. Not only that I disagree with you, but I think you're an enemy of the people, an enemy of the state, that you're trying to destroy this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of rhetoric is incredibly dangerous for a democracy.
You spent a lot of time amongst those that the defend us, time at war and on various places, Sebastian. Thinking about our conversation and your book, it made me wonder, have we to some extent drifted away from the time when that you subjugate the populace with spears and arrows to now where you're the battle space now for those who would wish to defeat freedom is between our ears, meaning the interwebs and social media and that sort of stuff?
Hold on. My little girl just came into the room. Hold on one second, sir. Sorry. I'm sorry about
that's
that.
Great. We pay the same. put her on the show. Let's chat with her.
A little reality intrusion. I have a 4-year-old girl who's just adorable, and she needed her pink butterfly backpack. So where were we?
Is the battle space now in the world up in between our ears versus spears and swords?
Well, Al Qaeda attacked us on 9/11 and killed 3,000 people, and they needed to be tracked down and captured or killed, right? And you're not going to do that with a war of ideas. I mean, American soldiers had to be in Afghanistan to do that. You're not going to fly SEAL Team 6 out of Virginia and make that happen. And along the way, we were trying to stabilize Afghanistan so that it wasn't a failed state, a rogue nation, where a group like Al Qaeda could take root. And we may be cycling right back into that. Who knows? But what I would say is that the war of ideas. It always helps to have America put our best foot forward in terms of being hopefully a benevolent and helpful presence in the world. Unless we need to defend ourselves. But the war of ideas really is one that takes place at home, and we really have to think of ourselves as a unity. And the really, really extreme rhetoric that has grown in this country, in my lifetime, in the last decade or so, it's a threat. It's a danger to us.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, the biggest threat, it is between our ears. I mean, we really do have to come around to the idea that we are all part of this amazing experiment, and we need everybody, even the people we disagree with. And, every marriage works that way. I mean, every single one, we all know that. So, think of the country as a huge marriage.
Outstanding. Sebastian, we've only got a minute left. I'd be neglectful if I didn't mention you're still doing the Vets Town Halls.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is taken from Native American ceremonies. One way to bring combat veterans back into the community is to give them a chance to talk to the community about what it felt like to serve, to fight. And, we all know a lot of vets, right? Some vets are going to be very proud, and some vets are going to be very angry, and some vets are going to be very sad, or a combination of all three. But when you do that, it's enormously cathartic and healthy, and it allows the citizenry to really be incorporated into what the reality of war is. And so the idea is that on Veterans Day, you open up the town halls in every community. And if you go onto my website, SebastianYunger.com, JUNGER, or VeteransTownHall.org, it lays out how to do this. And every Veterans Day, there's a forum for veterans to speak to their community. It's a wonderful thing, and I really urge people to do it. It costs zero money.
Sebastian, thank you so much to you and your daughter for spending some time with us on this weekend. We'd love to have you back sometime. Folks, look for the book Freedom. Should be in the bookstore when you hear this. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures will remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.